he was interrupted by a discreet cough behind him. Butso had come across silently from the other fire where the drivers and servants were bivouacked. "Henshaw," he started, when Ralph acknowledged him, "you told me that we had come here to hunt buffalo, to make trek reams from their hides," he accused. "Did you not trust me?"
"Butso, you are my brother."
"You lie to your brothers?"
"If I had spoken of the stones that burn in Bulawayo, we would have had 100 wagons following us when we left town."
"Did I not tell you that I had led my impi over these hills, chasing the same hairless baboon upon whom you now shower gifts?"
"You did not tell me," Ralph replied, and Butso moved on hastily from that subject. He was not proud of his campaign against Wanky, the only one during all the years that he had been an Induna of the Moles, which had not ended in complete success. He still recalled the old king's recriminations. Would that he could ever forget them.
"Henshaw, if you had spoken to me, we would not have had to waste our time and demean ourselves by parleying with this son of 30 fathers, this unsavoury jackal casting, this...
Ralph cut short Butso's opinion of their host by standing up and seizing Butso's shoulders. "Butso, can you lead us there? Is that what you mean? Can you take us to the stones that burn?"
Butso inclined his head in assent. "And it will not cost you a wagon either," he replied.
They rode into a red and smoky dawn through the open glades in the forest. Ahead of them the buffalo herds opened to give them passage, and closed behind them as they passed. The huge black beasts held their wet muzzles high, the massive slaty bosses of horn giving them a ponderous dignity, and they stared in stolid astonishment as the horsemen passed within a few hundred paces, and then returned unalarmed to graze. The riders barely glanced at them. Their attention was fastened instead on Batso's broad, bullet-scarred back, as he led them at an easy trot towards the low line of flat-topped hills that rose out of the forest ahead. On the first slope they tethered the horses and climbed, while above them the furry little brown clipspringer, swift as a chamois, flew sure-footed up the cliffs, and from the summit an old dog baboon barked his challenge down at them. Though they ran at the slope, they could not keep up with Butso, and he was waiting for them halfway up on a ledge above which the cliff rose sheer to the summit. He made no dramatic announcement, but merely pointed with his chin. Ralph and Harry stared, unable to speak, their chests heaving and their shirts plastered to their backs with sweat from the climb. There was a horizontal seam, 20 foot thick, sandwiched in the cliff face. It ran along the cliff as far as they could see in each direction, black as the darkest night, and yet glittering with a strange greenish iridescence in the slanted rays of the early sun.
"This was the only thing we lacked in this land," Ralph said quietly. "The stones that burn. Black gold. Now we have it all."
Harry Mellow went forward and laid his hand upon it reverently, as though he were a worshipper touching the relic of a saint in some holy place.
"I have never seen coal of this quality in a seam so deep, not even in the Kentucky hills."
Suddenly he snatched his hat off his head, and with a wild Indian whoop, threw it far out down the slope. "We're rich!" he shouted. "Rich! Rich! Rich!"
"Better than working for Mr. Rhodes, huh?" Ralph asked, and Harry grabbed his shoulders, and the two of them spun together in a yelling, stomping dance of jubilation on the narrow ledge, while Batso leaned against the seam of black coal and watched them unsmilingly. It took them 2 weeks to survey and peg their claims, covering all the ground beneath which the seams of coal might be buried. Harry shot the lines with his theodolite, and Butso and Ralph worked behind him with a gang of axemen, driving in the pegs and marking the corners with cairns of loose stones. While they worked, they discovered a dozen other places in the hills where the deep, rich seams of glittering coal were exposed at the surface.
"Coal for 1,000 years, Harry predicted. "Coal for the railways and the blast furnaces. Coal to power a new nation." On the fifth day, the two of them traipsed back to camp at the head of their bone-weary gang of Matabele. Victoria, deprived of her new husband for 2 weeks,
was as palely forlorn as a young widow in mourning, but by breakfast the following day she had regained her fine high colour and the sparkle in her eyes as she hovered over Harry, replenishing his coffee cup and heaping his plate with slices of smoked warthog and piles of rich yellow scrambled ostrich egg. Sitting at the head of the breakfast table, set under the giant masasa trees, Ralph called to Cathy.
"Break open a bottle of champagne, Katie, my sweeting. We've got something to celebrate."
And he saluted them with a brimming mug.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I give you a toast to the gold of the Harkness mine and the coal of the Wanky field, and to the riches of both."
They laughed and clinked their mugs and drank the toast.
"Let's stay here forever," said Vicky. "I'm so happy, I don't want it to end."
"We'll stay a little longer," Ralph agreed, with his arm about Cathy's waist. "I told Dr. Jim we were coming up here to hunt buffalo. If we don't bring a few wagon loads of hides back with us, the little doctor is going to start wondering."
The evening wind came softly out of the east. Ralph knew that at this season it would hold steadily during the night and increase with the warmth of the sun. He sent out two teams of his Matabele, each team armed with a package of swan vestas and leading a span of trek oxen. They moved out eastwards, and by dawn they had reached the bank of the Gwai River. Here they felled two big dried-out thorn trees and hooked the trek chains onto the branches. When they put fire into the branches, the dried wood burned like a torch, and the oxen panicked. The drivers ran beside each span, keeping them galloping in opposite directions, heading across the wind, dragging the blazing trees behind them, and spreading a trail of sparks and flaring twigs through the tall, dry grass. Within an hour there was a forest fire burning across a front of many miles, with the wind behind it roaring down towards the long, open flay where Ralph's wagons were outspanned. The smoke billowed heaven high, a vast dun pall. Ralph had roused the camp before first light, and he supervised the backburn while the dew on the flay subdued the flames and made them manageable. The Matabele put fire into the grass on the windward side of the open flay and let it burn to the forest line on the far side. Here they beat it out before it could take hold of the trees. Isasi rolled his wagons out onto the blackened, still hot earth and formed them into a square with his precious oxen penned in the centre. Then, for the first time, they had a chance to pause and look eastward. The dark smoke cloud of the forest fire blotted out the dawn, and their island of safety seemed suddenly very small in the path of that terrible conflagration. Even the mood of the usually cheerful Matabele was subdued, and they kept glancing uneasily at the boiling smoke line as they honed their skinning knives.
"We'll be covered with soot," Cathy complained. "Everything will be filthy."
"And a little singed, like as not," Ralph laughed, as he and Butso checked the spare horses and slipped the rifles into their scabbards.
Then he came to Cathy, and with an arm about her shoulders told her,
"You and Vicky are to stay in the wagons. Don't leave them, whatever happens. If you get a little warm, splash water on yourselves, but don't leave the wagons."
Then he sniffed the wind and caught the first whiff of smoke. He winked at Harry, who had Vicky in his arms in a lingering farewell.
"I'll bet my share of the Wanky field against yours."
"None of your crazy bets, Ralph Ballantyne," Vicky cut in quickly. "Harry has a wife to support now."
"A guinea, then," Ralph moderated the wager.
"Done," agreed Harry. They shook hands on it and swung up into the saddles. Butso led up Ralph's spare horse with a rifle in the scabbard and a bandolier of bright brass cartridges looped to the pommel.
"Keep close, Butso," Ralph told him, and looked across at Harry.
He had his own Matabele outrider and spare horse close behind him.
"Ready?"
Ralph asked, and Harry nodded, and they trotted out of the laager. The acrid stink of smoke was strong on the wind now, and the horses flared their nostrils nervously and stepped like cats over the hot ash of the backburn.
"Just look at them," Harry's voice was awed.
The herds of buffalo had begun moving downwind ahead of the bushfire. Gradually one herd had merged with another, 100 becoming 500, then 1,000. Then the 1,000 began multiplying, the westward movement becoming faster, black bodies packing closer, the earth beginning to tremble faintly under the iron black hooves. Now every few minutes one of the herd bulls, an animal so black and solid that he seemed to be hewn from rock, would stop and turn back, stemming the moving tide of breeding cows. He would lift his mighty horned head with its crenellated bosses and snuffle the east wind into his wet nostrils, blank at the sting of the smoke, turn again and break into a heavy swinging trot, and his cows would be infected by his agitation, while the red calves bawled in bewilderment and pressed to the flanks of their dams. Now the herds were being compressed against each other. The huge beasts, the largest of them a ton and a half of flesh and bone, were moving shoulder to shoulder and muzzle to tail across a front almost a mile wide. The leaders came cascading out of the forest onto the edge of the fillet, while the serried ranks reached back into the looming dust and were hidden by the twisted silver trunks of the masasa trees. Ralph knotted the scarf up over his nose and mouth and pulled his hat low over his eyes. "Harry, my lad, everyone that falls this side of the wagons," he made a wide gesture, "is mine. Everything that side is yours." "And a guinea on the bag," Harry agreed. He levered a cartridge into the breech of his Lee Enfield rifle, and with one of his wild Indian whoops, clapped his heels into his horse's flanks, and drove straight at the nearest beasts. Ralph let him go, and held his own horse down to a trot. Gently he angled in towards the rolling herds, careful not to spook them prematurely, letting them concentrate on the flames behind rather than the hunter ahead. This way he got in really close, and picked out a good bull in the front rank. He leaned into the rifle, and aimed into the barrel of the thick neck, just where the bald, scabby hide creased at the front of the shoulder. The shot was almost drowned by the din of pounding hooves and bawling calves, but the bull dropped his nose to the earth and somersaulted over it, sliding onto his back, kicking convulsively in his death agony, and bellowing as mournfully as a foghorn in a winter gale. The herds plunged into a full gallop. Steering his mount with his heels and toes, leaving both hands free to load and aim and fire, Ralph pressed in against the wall of dark bodies in gargantuan flight. Sometimes he was so close that the rifle muzzle was merely inches from a monstrous neck or shoulder, and the muzzle flash was quick and bright as a lance as it buried itself in the thick black hide. At each crash of the rifle, another beast went down, for at that range an experienced huntsman could make a butchery of it. He fired until the hammer fell on an empty chamber, and then crammed fresh rounds into the magazine, and fired again as fast as he could pump the loading handle, not lifting the butt from his shoulder nor his eye from the sights. The barrel was smoking hot, each shot now recoiling viciously into his shoulder, so that his teeth cracked together in his jaws, and the forefinger of his right hand was bleeding, a flap of loose skin torn from the second joint by the trigger guard. So he was seconds slow on the reload, and then he was firing again. Deafened by gunfire, each shot was a muted popping in his abused eardrums, and the uproar of the galloping, bawling, bellowing herd was dreamlike and far away. His vision was dulled by the head-high bank of dust, and as they tore once more into the forest, by the sombre shadows of the treetops that met overhead. He was bleeding from chin and lip and forehead, where stones as big as acorns had been thrown into his face by the flying hooves ahead of him. Still he loaded and fired and reloaded. He had long ago lost all count of the bag, and the endless herd still pressed close on both flanks of his floundering horse. Suddenly, one bandolier was empty. 100 rounds fired, he realized with surprise, and Ralph pulled a fresh one from his saddlebag, instinctively ducking under a long branch and straightening up to find an enormous bull galloping half a length ahead of him.